Welcome. You are listening to the Retirement Lifestyle Show with Roshan Lungani, Eric Olson, and Adrian Nicholson. This show is an exploration of ideas to help you work toward your ideal retirement. Get ready for the financial independence of your dreams.
Welcome to the Retirement Lifestyle Show. I'm your co-host, Roshan Lungani. I'm happy to have Eric and Adrian back. This is the first time we've all been together in about 6 weeks. Eric, I'll start with you saying welcome back, Eric. How was the trip?
Oh, it was amazing. For our listeners, I was away for 40 days, and 21 of those were driving up the Pacific Coast, pretty much from San Diego all the way to the northwest tip of Washington. If you have not hugged that coast and seen those amazing vistas, put that on your bucket list, folks. That is a fantastic, fantastic trip.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. And Adrian, welcome back. You also were out last week, not for as long. How was your trip?
It's good to be back. My trip was great. Went up to Maine with my wife, saw my in-laws. Really great time. Got to go to a lake, an island, did a lot of stuff by the water. Also did a lazy river. So it was definitely my ideal vacation, but I'm glad to be back. I don't like the driving as much as Eric did. All that driving, I don't think I'd like that at all. I'm not the biggest fan of road trips. I just like the destination, but can't complain too much.
And how about you, Roshan?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to be back. I was out a few weeks ago, but I was back last week. We had a great episode, so I'm happy to have all of us back together again. I like routine and getting back to normal.
Okay.
Well, yeah, so we've got a great topic today. I'm really excited for this one. So the three of us are going to share some of the lessons we've learned from the past year and a half or so in the market, a little longer, with the decline in 2022, the subsequent recovery that we've had so far in 2023. I think this is a very valuable topic for us to discuss. I've often heard that you'll hear when people talk about investing, they'll talk about compounding, growing your money. I think Einstein has a quote saying it's one of the greatest phenomenons out there. Well, investing knowledge also compounds. The more you learn, the more you see, the more valuable it becomes. I always talk about Buffett and being such a Buffett fan. Well, you know, he's got, you know, 50 plus years of investing, a lot more than that he's done, which is partly why he's able to make decisions and move so quickly. When you have a market like we just did with the decline, I think those tend to have more lessons. You can be right accidentally with an investment, but when you're wrong, there's typically a reason behind it, or at least you can break it down. You don't break down, hey, why I was right, as much as you break down why I was wrong. So I think sharing lessons we've learned from the last year and a half, not necessarily saying we were right or wrong. Some of it is things that we will keep doing that we think we're right to begin with. But Adrian, I'll start with you. What's a lesson or something that you're going to keep doing, something new that you learned from the last year and a half or so?
Yeah, I'd be happy to start off. So one of the biggest things sometimes we talk about, especially when it comes to market fluctuation, volatility, just the swings of the market, is the timing aspect. That can be really difficult for anybody to identify, just to try and make as much money as they can. And the biggest thing that you can do to just really take the timing aspect out of this is just doing your research, finding investments, companies, whatever it is that is profitable, that will do well in the short term, long term, whatever it may be. And that's just something that I think is a good starting point for us to discuss.
Before you leave that, Adrian, when you say that the timing aspect, what precisely do you mean? Are you saying that people have attempted to time it and you would discourage them from doing so? Or you'd say that actually people were too committed to a buy and hold and you think that they should have been more attentive to how they might time things?
Yeah, that's a great question, Eric. So when there is a lot of volatility in the market, when you have a year like 2022, there's just a lot of conversations people are having, looking at the markets. Hey, when is the bottom going to hit? When is the recovery going to happen? Should I making adjustments now? Should I keep the strategy I have? So it's just a lot of emotion, a lot of conversations around it, a lot of discussions being brought forth. So that's where also the timing aspect has, because everybody really just has sometimes a very short-term outlook. When I say that, when there's so much volatilities and swings in the market, it pretty much draws a lot of attention. So that's where I'm talking about the timing aspect of it, where when you have a year like 2022, where you have stocks and bonds going down, people are just going to see, all right, when's the recovery? Is this going to continue? People have a short-term time frame when they look at that, not really sometimes being drawn away from their long-term goals or whatever it may be. So that's the thing where I thought it'd be worth having this discussion, just beginning this discussion as well.
Maybe I'm just not hearing precisely the point that you're making, so I'm just going to push it a little bit further, and you can just clarify for me. Hopefully, I'm the only one, and our listeners are going, Eric, come on. Don't. So it sounds like what you're saying instead is, we tend to be so micro-focused on the short-term movements of the markets rather than taking the long-term view of our, that is the foundation for our investing in the first place. Don't allow your sort of short-term observations to derail your long-term plan. Is that, am I in the neighborhood?
It's a good point. Yes, exactly. You're in the neighborhood, Eric. And when you have a year like last year with the markets going down, like I said, stocks and bonds going down so much, it's just something where people really need to go back and just do your research, do your homework, because that's something that is really vital when it comes to investing as well. And really just really disregards timing and time frames in general, where you're looking for, especially when it comes to investing, something profitable, something that's going to pay you whatever your time frame is. So that's the reason why I started this conversation, because, you know, that's when you invest for so long and so many years, you're going to have years like 2022. And when you do have that, if you do your research, if you have certain strategies and principles put in place, it does help you when you have market fluctuations like that.
And Eric, I'm going to answer that as well, because I had something similar on my list. Adrian, if you don't mind, I'll share my version, but similar point. I would change that a little bit to, don't spend time on market direction / timing. And what I mean by that is, I feel like the media, and I'm not blaming the media, but whether it's shows, articles, or so on, people will constantly say, we think the market's going to do X. It's going to go up. It's going to go down. I actually saw one today that said why the S&P is going to go down to 4,100. And a year ago, I would have clicked on it and read the article. A year later, what I'm saying is, I wouldn't click on the article, and I would advise you not to click on it, because I think that's a waste of time. The reason I think that's a waste of time is, I think you're unlikely to get the timing correct of the market. It's too short-term focused, and I'd call it noise. I would say your time is better spent looking for investment opportunities versus trying to figure out the short-term movement of the market.
Well, I'll chime in on this too. One is the lesson for me about timing, the timing question and focusing on direction and such, is at least threefold. So number one, it connects to the lesson that the interplay between the global economy, the national economy, and the markets is a much more complex thing than I had assumed it would be. And the post-COVID workout of all of the disequilibria that were introduced during that phase, and in the aftermath, as well as not just by the disease itself, but also by the government responses to all of that, has much to do with the difficulty of making sense of what conventionally would have seemed like fairly clear indicators. Let me give an example of that. We've talked at ad nauseum about the inverted yield curve, and about how that is has so reliably pointed to a recession. And yet at the same time, when you look at, it doesn't look like the economy and the economic indicators are playing ball with that particular inverted yield curve. Why is that? Well, it seems uniquely a byproduct of some attributes of the Federal Reserve's intervention, super rapid increase in the interest rate environment, as you know, as well as some other variables there as well. So number one, I've been super struck by the complexity and I think invited by that discovery to go back into the both the research literature and the historical economic history to try to understand what are the precedents for things of this kind and how can I have a deeper understanding the next time we run into some novel conflation of all of these different forces. That's lesson number one. Before you respond, before I proceed, do you have any sort of reactions to that comment?
I do. I'll tell you, added on to what I said of managing time, I did what you just described, and I've read a lot about comparisons to, I think it was the 40s, definitely comparisons to the 70s of the markets, and I think my time was wasted there as well. And the reason I'll tell you that is it reminds me of the Mark Twain quote, history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. Each market's different, right? And with what you've got going on here, that in my conclusion after doing this research and what's happened with the market to this point, where I think it's different is that I think compared to the 70s, you had inflation like you did now. We could argue we created inflation this time, we didn't last time. And what I'm referring to specifically is COVID stimulus. Right. The other thing that we look at comparing those markets is the employment data and employment information. Right now, that's held pretty steady. So I'd say they don't repeat themselves comparing it to either of the market, but they rhyme. There are similarities, but do I think knowing those similarities may have made me feel better? And I shared that information with my clients. It may have helped them feel better. But if I had to do it over again, I would have spent that time just looking for good companies to take advantage of the market as opposed to trying to make myself feel better by looking at a previous market and saying, how are they going to be similar?
All right. Well, that is interesting.
And I'm open to counterpoint. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as well. Or if you want to go on to the second point, you said you had two that apply.
No, first of all, I'm going to use an analogy that maybe will register most readily with those of our clients that have had some sort of advanced statistics. I'm sorry for those of you who haven't. I'll just say this. There's a statistical technique known as multivariate linear regression, and there are other variations on that theme. But what they try to do is to disentangle when you have a complex set of causes that have at least purportedly some influence on an outcome of some kind. For example, here talking about inflation, was that COVID stimulus? Was that just tremendous contraction in supply? And so the imbalance of supply and demand, you know, what were the causes of all of that? Multivariate regression, which is, I'm not advocating that in this case, but does a nice job of helping you see the individual effect of all of that. In this case, we're not doing it quantitatively quite so much as qualitatively. And I think that is useful to try to understand just how powerful some of these forces are so that the next time, in echoing Mark Twain's saying, next time history rhymes, I'll at least have a clear sense of which of the forces that are evident before us at the time have perhaps got the most potency in influencing a set of outcomes. So, well, anyway, but I wouldn't disagree with your point about looking for opportunities, not one bit. The second lesson, I guess, that I've learned with respect to timing is actually probably go further in the direction of timing than I have done. Which is precisely the opposite of what you said. So this could be entirely random, but I've mentioned, I'm not trying to advocate them at all. By the way, I'm going to issue our standard disclaimer. Please don't take anything we're saying here to be a recommendation for you. This is just an educational opportunity. If you have questions about this or are thinking about taking some action on the basis of some of the things we're saying, please consult an advisor. If you don't have one, reach out to us and we'll have a conversation with you. But I run some strategies that have deliberately adaptive elements to them. And in some cases, they're looking for market downturns and they get to the sideline. And then other terms, they're timed to looking for a market opportunity and get back in, perhaps more than people's own reasoning or let alone their emotions might incline them to do. So in that sense, you have some rule-based approaches that allow you to do some timing. I'm very much a believer in rule-based approaches, by the way, instead of subjective-based approaches. I think subjective-based approaches get it wrong more often than not. Rule-based ones, if the rules are good, get it right more often than not, or at least hopefully they do.
Eric, would you mind just giving an example of a subjective base rule or just a subjective, however you described it?
Yeah, I don't like that the market is going down. I particularly don't like the bond market is going down. I'm a conservative investor. Get me to cash right now. That's a subjective rule and or a subjective response to it. Whereas one of the strategies that I use, I've talked about it some, it blends 50 stocks. There are attempts to hold 50 stocks at any given time. If there are no stocks that meet the qualifications or are too few, at least it can whittle that down and be half of it in cash and only half, the other half in 25 stocks, or it can be 70% in cash and the other half in only 15 stocks. I mean, it can go, you know, various ways. But over the last 3 years, that's been compounding in excess of 15% with a not bad downturn during 2022. I think during 2022, it was down about 10%, somewhere in that neighborhood. So what that tells me is that rule-based timing systems can be very effective. I have other systems as well that are over that same time frame up about 10 and what have you. So what it's served to do for me, at least, is to reinforce the value of having a rule-based timing system as one part, not the only part, not the entire part, but as one part of the overall allocation of a portfolio. If you have some of it that's behaving or that's being managed according to an algorithm as opposed to strictly a buy and hold, there may be an opportunity there.
Well, so I want to touch on two things you said. One of the things I have on my list that is something to stick with as opposed to something new is, Eric, what you described. I still think multiple strategies in a portfolio are a brilliant way to go. And we've talked about that all the time. And to me, the last year market just underscored that, as you said, just a part of the portfolio in something like this. We talked about it before. The phrase you always see in investment literature is can have extended periods of underperformance. Well, that's why you have multiple strategies. The other thing I want to say with your subjective approach, I was talking to a friend a year ago, right, January roughly of 2022, he goes, I think the market's going down. I'm going to cash. Goes to cash fully. Talked to him literally a week ago, and he mentions, yeah, he's still in cash. So I asked him, well, why'd you stay in cash all this time? He had said, well, actually, I didn't have time to deal with it. I had all this other stuff going on. I forgot about it. And the guy I work with never called me back. Then he asked me, do you think it's too late? And I said, well, the positive is from when you went in cash, you're actually still a little bit ahead. The market's still below there. But the point that brings up with subjective measures is, one, they could be wrong, right? Subjective measures could be wrong, but two, something can happen where you, in his case, forget about it and forget to make the move. He had a lot of serious stuff going on. So someone who's unexpected. So someone who's thinking, well, I can make this move. I won't forget about it. Well, I think that could happen to anybody. He wasn't negligent. He just had personal issues that were more important than finance at the time. But when you make these moves to jump in and out, you've got to be right twice. You got to be right when you get out and right when you get in. And that's where the timing thing we discussed, I would encourage against doing, right? The timing stuff, or at the very least, the way I was putting it, I wouldn't spend my time on it because I think your time's better spent looking for good investments. I have another lesson that goes well with timing, unless either of you have something to share with this part still.
I have one last thing on the timing thing, and that is I have become, as our listeners will understand, because we've been talking about this for a couple of years now, about one particular indicator as enormously insightful or provides a lot of insight, I would say, into the thinking and outlook of some really careful students of the markets, and that's namely the high yield spread which reveals, irrespective of what they may say, what professional investors in the fixed income space or the bond space are truly, what their outlook and their capacity or their tolerance for risk really is at any given moment. And watching when they're freaking out and getting more freaked out and having some sense of what that is a good guide to probably back off somewhat from a full-on aggressive approach. And conversely, when that turns, and yes, they're still somewhat nervous, but they're ready to re-engage, and you can see they're getting increasingly confident. Don't wait much longer than that to try to take advantage of that opportunity. Will that approach always be right? No, for sure not. For sure it will not be, but it appears that it's pretty consistent with, if you've followed that and a little bit more flavor to that commentary than I'm prepared to offer right now. But if you watch carefully how they're or manifesting what their actual outlook is and shape some of your portfolio direction in accordance with that, I think that's a very fruitful way to have some adaptivity to your portfolio, which is a timing question.
It is. And I think I've added it on my notes. I think this should be a topic we cover in its own episode. To come back to it, I'll go on to what I've got next that does line up with timing, and I'll share a story with this. So the lesson, I called it "Don't put yourself on a clock," and what this was specifically speaking, there is a stock that I like. This is a personal lesson. Did not have client portfolios. Just me myself did this. There is a stock I like that declined as the market went down. I liked it as a long term investment, and so I wanted to add to it. And I thought, I'm going to buy some call options to add to this investment. So I sold my shares. I took the same dollars, bought some call options, which gave me exposure to more shares. Well, I was right. I was 3 months early. What 3 months early means when you own calls is I lost my capital. I got zero for that investment. Had I had 3 months longer, I would have been right and I would have had a double in my investment. So the lesson I would share here, there are many of them in there, but for me, I called it "Don't put yourself on a clock." Being right but with the wrong timing is one and the same. You're still wrong. So if I had to go back and do it over again, and I wanted to add to the investment, I would have added shares or just held what I had. Just holding what I had would have led to a handsome profit as well. Not a double, but a good profit, roughly a 50% gain instead of a zero. So that's one of the things that I think that quite frankly, I should have known before, but I maybe that's another lesson in it, right? Where I feel like I should have known this already, but I thought I had an opportunity and I just was wrong with that. Gentlemen, anything to share on that one?
That does just remind me and just makes me think of too, where I talked about in the beginning of this podcast, like, do your research, find investments or companies out there that are profitable, making money, good, solid companies. However, what you mentioned too, Roshan, with the time frame aspect of it, markets can be unpredictable, and especially where you have a year like 2022, you might have a great company that makes a lot of money. However, we saw last year a lot of great companies, their stock price still went down. So markets can be unpredictable. You can do your homework and find something solid, but sometimes you have that systemic risk, that market risk, where it will just go down with everything else. And that's just something too that you just have to consider as well and be ready for.
I agree completely. Even if you're right, the market can take longer than you to come to the same conclusion, right? And the market will always win. You know, I think of the sports analogy where they say Father Time is undefeated. Well, the markets are undefeated as well.
Mm-hmm. I'll just echo then on that unpredictability or that uncertainty before I comment on it, let me just make sure that I'm understanding the point correctly, Roshan, and that is that we can be right, but not necessarily right in a timely way. And as a result, that can harm us.
Yeah, I think this is a different take on timing, right? This was not a take on betting the direction of the market. This was, and like the way I said it, I put myself on a clock. Right. I inadvertently made myself a timer of the market, where I was trying to invest in a company and I understood what was doing. This was not an accident, but the 3 month time frame and the completely different outcome of a 50 to 100% gain versus a 100% loss just underscores it so much. And I'd want to share that lesson to others so that they don't make the same mistake. To me, this whole episode, the value of it is to make everyone else a better investor and to share some of our lessons so they don't make the same mistake. So that would be my answer. You know, It also goes back to the old Buffett quote, which I knew before this and learned the lesson the hard way on this one, which is it's something to the effect of three things that can make a smart man broke, I think, and it's liquor, ladies, and leverage. Well, this one was leverage. Right. And I shouldn't have been using the leverage because I wanted the leverage. That's what put me on a clock. And that's why I ended up with the negative outcome.
Well, that you've used that quote before. I do think that is interesting. So I want to echo that in just the following way, just as in the same way as you can be off on those sometimes and you make a move that proves to be wrong. At other times, you make a move because your rule tells you to, even though your mind tells you this doesn't make sense. So early in 2023, I mean to say, early in this calendar year. So I'm talking about now, but especially in March, the one of the models that I have relies on, you know, just purely fundamental and technical indicators to arrive at a hot list or a recommended list. And whether I like it or not, I implement according to the rules. This is a time where the Federal Reserve was still raising rates. You might remember we were still reading pretty high inflation numbers. So yes, we'd had some cooling, but no one was of the view that we were at that point going to be seeing prints on inflation in the threes or fours. That just seemed so, so far out. And so I was looking at that and saying, well, interest rates are pretty high. If you want to borrow to buy a home, that's pretty high. It's going to cool the housing market. But nevertheless, my one of my models said, get into pretty heavily into the home builders. And one of the things that's happened in that time frame is that the home builders have just been truly off to the races. That's been true not just in that category, but in the engineering and construction area as well. You know, that's not the only category, but the home builders have been one of the, you know, the big gainers since that time. I'm not saying this would be true for everybody, but things that we put on in early March and holding until now. So it's just in this case, you know, you're talking about 5 months, we're seeing 40, 50, 60% returns on that category. I would not have, I thought, I don't like the fact that it's over concentrating into this particular category. I don't fully understand why it is. I don't think it makes sense to me from a standpoint of the interest rate environment. And nevertheless, that particular trade has worked out really, really well. So point being, a disciplined approach as opposed, again, to a subjective approach, I think, especially if you've got rules that you've seen work in a variety of environments, can be a really useful thing.
Yeah, completely agree with that. In retrospect, that makes a lot of sense with the home builders because I've got exposure to those over the last earlier than you. But yeah, I've seen the same takeoff in the last few months is that people don't want to sell their homes with these 3% interest rates to buy another one at 7, but we still have a housing shortage. So who's the opportunity with? It's the home builders. Plus, home builders oftentimes own their own mortgage company and can offer these teaser rates or specialty rates to get people in. So I didn't know that at the time. I've read about it after, but in retrospect, it makes sense.
Yeah. So Eric, do you mind? One more thing comes to mind because you brought up the subjective approach again, and just advocating maybe for that one listener or viewer out there that's like, hey, Eric, I have a subjective approach that's really saved me a couple of times in the past. Can you maybe give me an example of how it might benefit somebody or has worked out in the past? Do you know anything like that? Or just give the pros side of it because you seem like very against it. And I just want to play both sides here for anybody out there that just wants to hear it.
Okay, no, that I think is totally reasonable, Adrian. Totally reasonable. Well, what is the saying, you know, even a broken clock has the time right twice a day. And so when there are some people that would you agree that more often than not, the instances in which you've seen an emotion driven shift in a portfolio, it is not to move into the markets, it's to move out of the markets. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay. And sometimes the market response and the emotional response to some sort of external catalyst for a shift in direction are pretty close in time. And I would say you could certainly indicate that around 9/11, and you could certainly indicate that around, you know, that's going back a long, long way, but to seeing some of the things unfolding in the housing market in 2008. So you had a number, or with mortgages, at least subprime mortgages, and the decimation of many of the financial institutions that package those up as securities. So we saw some people get out at a reasonable exit point in some of those crises. The problem is, it's seldom the case that they then re-enter at a comparably opportune moment. And as a result, there's left in cash for years. I had clients came in, and sometimes the emotional drivers of this are even more subjective than just observing that the economy has run into a catalyst for a change in direction. I remember when the 2016 election was in place, people were extremely, I would say, disrupted by the choice in the two candidates that we had for the two parties at that point in time. And people, many of them were taking sides on this. And if they got, you know, they didn't get the outcome that they were looking at that case, or similarly in 2020 with the presidential election, if they didn't get the outcome that they were looking for, they would exit the market fearing that things were going to go terribly awry. Well, following at least initially the 2016 presidential election, the markets responded very favorably. And following the 2020 election with a completely different party, the markets responded very favorably.
Well, let me interrupt. Initially. I've got such a good story for this from what you described about the emotional attachment and so on. Got a client I'm working with now. I've been working with her for a few years. She got divorced. Her husband handled the finances right in 2008, 2009. So she takes over her portion of the finances that she got, her personal investments, sells them all because they're all down in 2008 and 2009. So I'm speaking with her this last week, and it's been a struggle to get her to get out of cash. When I say she sold all her investments, she's been in cash since 2008 because her only experience in investing is also, I think, somewhat emotionally tied to a divorce, right? It is, but I think she's connecting both of those. But her only experience with investing is a 30% loss and a divorce at the same time, right? And so I was walking her through why it makes sense to do this, and just going that we were talking about indexes, right? And so I literally went back and I was like, if you had just left your money in the index, now I don't know what stock she owned in 2008, but in the S&P 500 index, it literally would be worth triple. And I'm not telling you to put all your money in the index or anything like that to her. What I'm trying to tell her to do is have your mind open to something other than keeping your money in the bank. And so we've made some progress. We've got treasuries, right? So that's an improvement. But I'm hoping it still continues. But Adrian, to your point, your initial question of subjective situation, and this is not a situation of it not working out. She's going to be fine to retire, even though it's in cash. The way her lifestyle is and the amount she has, she'll be fine. So that's a situation where the subjective thing didn't necessarily lead to a negative outcome, but she is concerned about her finances, even though she's okay. I think she'd be less concerned if she had three times as much, which would have been the case of, Eric, what you described of selling out of the market versus getting back in, or even the story I had about a friend who sold last year. If you sell, fine, when do you get back in? Which is where Eric's rule-based systems, I think, are very important if you're gonna make that kind of a drastic move. And like I always say, you've gotta be right twice. Right. It's hard enough to get one of those right, you know, selling and then the market does go down. But then when do you buy in? And the friend I mentioned that sold in January, his whole situation now is, am I too late? Have I missed the boat? Right. Because of the bottoming and recovery. So that's a lot. Adrian, for your question, I think I kind of answered it on the wrong side, not necessarily a positive outcome of it. But I like what Eric started his response with, saying a broken clock is right two times a day.
You know, I mean, those are all great points. And that's just the theme, I guess, of our discussion today. And just with investing in general, you really do have to just look at your successes and your failures, and just got to ask yourself, hey, what can I learn from this to make me better, and how can I move forward from it? Are all great points.
I'll go on to the next one I've got on here, which is having to do this over again. If we were, or whenever history rhymes again, as we've been saying, if I'm concerned about the market, rather than hedging with a short or a short ETF, I would actually go to cash. And the reason I say that is because cash doesn't lose money. Right. If you're wrong about a hedge, that hedge loses money. Now, granted, you've got other things making money that's offset it, so you're still net positive. I still don't like losing money. Right. Even if the portfolio went up. So let me give you just some really basic numbers on this for someone listening. Let's say you invest $100,000, you put $70,000 in the market going up and $30,000 in the market going down. Let's say the markets go up 10%. Well, that $70,000 made 10%, so it made $7,000, but that $30,000 lost 10%, so it lost $3,000. So your portfolio there is up $4,000 or 4%, and the markets are up 10%. In that same scenario, if you went to cash, the portfolio would be up 7 versus the markets being up 10. This is not a conversation necessarily. The point is not comparing versus the market. It's just that I'd rather be sitting in cash waiting patiently than losing money, for one. For two, it's not easy to find a good investment opportunity, right? There's a lot of talk. We've had episodes about this, about market efficiency. I'd agree to the statement, the markets are mostly efficient. And if you're trying to find a good investment opportunity, you're trying to find one of those rare efficiencies. Well, you're watering it down with these hedges if you are holding on to them. So going back to my initial point, my lesson, or what I would do differently next time, is I'm concerned about the market. That's valid. I'm going to cash, as opposed to saying I'm going to hedge the portfolio. Thoughts on that?
I'm maybe not quite as...
You don't have to agree. Let's argue about it, but that's where I'm at.
I would say there are times when it's both behaviorally easier, and sometimes for tax reasons, it's also easier. And maybe even third, from a trading cost standpoint, it's a little easier.
Which is easier, the cash or the... You're saying cash?
No, to put on a hedge rather than a cash. Because in your example, that where it was 70% long in the market, and then 30% inverse hedge. In that case, the client was attempting to be only at 40% of market exposed. And as a result, they got, in your hypothetical scenario, they got precisely that 40% market exposure outcome. As it happened in that setting, the market was rising. And so they suffered the missed opportunity. There was an opportunity cost there. But if in that same period, let's say the broad market had fallen by 10, And so they lost $70,000 on the 70% that was engaged in the market, but with their one-to-one inverse hedge, that 30%, they actually picked up $3,000. In this case, what they did is they softened the damage to $4,000 rather than $10,000. You know, so it can work both ways. So the question is, are we good at putting on hedges in a timely way? And there again, I would say it's less the hedge that's the part that troubles me, and it's more the emotional application of the hedge that troubles me.
Well, so I'll give you, just to go further with that, these were rules-based and not emotional-driven. Hedges,
oh, okay.
For one.
All right.
For two, mm-hmm. I do think you're right. It can cut either way. The hedges could have worked. The indicators could have been right, and the markets went down, and it would have softened the blow. That is completely correct. What I don't like about this, why I wouldn't repeat it, is one, as we started off the episode talking about, don't time the market. I think putting on those hedges do have a timing aspect. Unless you permanently have them, which is not the case in this scenario. And B, what I originally said with this point is the hedges can lose money, whereas cash is not going to lose money. We're not talking about purchasing power and inflation right now. I'm just talking about pure dollars in that time frame. And that's the part the amount the hedges would make, it would not be sufficient enough in this same 10% scenario we're talking about to offset the possibility of loss.
That's just why. So you don't think I'm here to do point counterpoint. I will just affirm that in my models that have that go to cash element, they don't tend there. I do have a little room in one of the models to apply very, very gentle inverse market instruments. But when they say, hey, disengage, when the rules say disengage, it does go to cash or very short term bonds.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent. I'll give you the last one I've got on here, which was, I think down markets help define who you are as an investor, right? And why I say that is because you're going to be comfortable when you're making money. What makes you uncomfortable when you're not? And so the hedges I mentioned are one thing that, you know, they lost money. I was not comfortable with it, because when I own a stock that's down or a company that's down, or even the index, quite frankly, that's down, I feel comfortable that it's going to come back, right? And so my next point is, I'd rather own a good business in a bad market than the market, you know, meaning the index, or even some sort of hedge. What I mean by that is that what I define a good business at is a business that's growing at a pace faster than the market as a whole. So when I own that type of business, if that stock has declined with the down market, even if it's declined greater than the market, assuming the fundamentals of the business haven't changed, to me, that truly is a buying opportunity. And if not a buying opportunity, I feel comfortable holding, right? The markets will eventually give me credit, so to speak, for this business growing. And just because the markets were down in 2022, if the business is growing 10% a year, 20% a year, well, that business is actually worth more, and eventually the stock price will follow. That's my thought and my feeling. So, and I put it this way because we talked about multiple strategies. Well, we had strategies that do these hedges, right? And some of them that were right. I feel more comfortable just owning that business than I feel putting the hedge on or off, even though it's rule-based, even though one of them is algorithm-driven, so I'm not making the call. The black box is, what am I more comfortable owning? And quite frankly, when I compare performance, what is outperformed? It's owning the good business in the long run. Right. And that has other complications. Please check the Art of Investing episodes we have if you're curious as to what I view as a good business, or you want to go find one on your own. We've got that information there for you. But the point stands, I'd rather stand on the merits of the business that the markets will eventually give it credit than stand on the merits of the algorithm with timing, which has worked historically. Once again, this is speaking to my personal comfort level. Right? So these things have worked. It's not that they haven't worked. It's just that when the markets shift and adjust, my concern is it worked. It's worked before. I hope it continues working. Whereas when I own the business, as long as nothing's changed, as long as the business is doing the same thing, I'm not relying on hope in my mind as much as I'm relying on the business just continuing. Thoughts on that one, gentlemen?
Oh, I'm going to be always defaulting to a preference for algorithms than individual stock selection, but that's again a personality thing more than anything.
Well, you know, I'll tell you just a comment on that. The title of that episode, "The Art of Investing," I think is a great way to actually describe it. And Eric, don't let me put words in your mouth. Please tell me what you think about it. But you are more scientifically driven with this. On the investing side of things?
People, I would say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm not saying one is better or worse. I think that's better for you, whereas finding the businesses that are better for me, right? We each determine our comfort level, which might be, I don't think that this would be a lesson in that market. I think you know where you stand before, and a down market helps you either pivot to a different play within the same realm, just realize what you're a little bit more comfortable with versus the other, or helps validate that you are still comfortable with this methodology.
Are we still citing lessons? Because I can go to another.
Yes.
I think one of the lessons that I've learned, or have I seen reinforced certainly, has been the role of monetary policy. And I think, as you've heard, listeners have heard me say numerous times, I've been somewhat critical of the interest rate lever as opposed to the money supply lever being the primary tool that the Fed had used to try to stem the inflation. But as it happened behind the scenes, by virtue of the fact that they weren't renewing some of the, as bonds came due, that they had previously put out there, in effect, what they were doing was altering some of the money supply and their interest rates, this time insofar as they filtered into the cash market and money market fund, I should say, as opposed to cash market, had money that came off of the sidelines and went into you know, other instruments that were interest bearing, in particular treasuries and a lot of I bonds. Treasuries and I bonds are not included in the M2 formula, so but they are a little bit less liquid, and that has served, I think, to temper some of that inflation as we've talked about. So the role of money supply, I'm more a monetarist than I was before I went into this, I think is what I'm saying. And for those of you who think, what is a monetarist? It's somebody who believes that money, the controlling money supply, is one of the things that helps streamline or smooth out some of what could otherwise be the quite abrupt shifts in growth and contraction cycles in the economy. The second thing, though, is a lesson I'm still learning. Once upon a time, I poo-pooed the idea of don't fight the Fed. That was a mistake. And I think the older I've gotten, the more I've seen, or at least come to conclude, that what I thought was a bromide, don't fight the Fed, was in fact, it's a very succinct statement of an underlying reality, is their capacity to move those levers can outdo even your most careful algorithms and your most careful stock picks. So don't be, you know, take what they're doing seriously. That said, I would say in 2023, at least, I am a little bit puzzled by the fact that the Fed continues to articulate an outlook that is one thing, and the markets are, at least, are evidencing us a psychology of investors that's a very different thing. It looks as though the Fed is trying to put the kibosh on the labor market, and companies have just not yet really been on a widespread basis throwing in the towel there. They continue to have, you know, fairly strong employment numbers. I'm not saying there's no effect there, but it's nothing the same. And if you look at how much the market has responded right now, it looks as though on balance, market participants are quite optimistic, or at least increasingly optimistic, compared to where they were, let's say, 8 or 9 months ago, which is surprising to me. I am surprised by that. And so that's a lesson I'm still trying to process and digest here, the 2023 lesson about the Fed and the markets.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you said. Don't fight the Fed. But what I was going to say was your point of that really depends on what time you're looking at. 2022, don't fight the Fed, was accurate. 2023, as you had said, the market seem to be fighting the Fed, and so far winning that battle, right? And so my conclusion on that is I definitely agree with the statement, don't fight the Fed. I wouldn't want to be on the opposite side of the Fed for sure. However, I think what's different in 2023 versus 2022 is fighting the Fed is now essentially betting how either will we be in the recession or not, or it's fighting when the policy will end as opposed to fighting the policy as a whole. So the vast, when it's all written, the majority of the raises were done in 2022, right? And so now they're betting when's there going to be a cut. So I would say the 2022 bet is not fighting the Fed. It's actually betting on the Fed pivoting, which would be my thought on the market going the way they have been. Any other lessons to add?
I think we could do this for another hour, but insofar as we've been talking for about 50 minutes, we should probably give our listeners' ears a rest or keep them hungry for next week.
Yep. If we have more, we will definitely share it again. Thank you for listening, Adrian, Eric. It's great to be back together. For everyone listening, please like, subscribe, give us five stars, tell your friends and family, and we'll be back next week with another great episode of the Retirement Lifestyle Show. Take control and achieve your goals.
Schedule a conversation with Roshan, Adrian, or Eric today at retirementlifestyleshow.com. Roshan and Eric are certified financial planner practitioners. They, along with Adrian, are investment advisor representatives and serve clients across the U.S. with financial planning and investment advice through Arete Wealth. If you found this show helpful, gained knowledge, or enjoyed the time you spent with us, tell your friends and leave us a 5-star review. This will help others discover the show. To access our show notes, to download any of the tools mentioned in today's podcast, to ask us a question, or to schedule a conversation, go to retirementlifestyleshow.com. All opinions expressed by podcast hosts and guests are solely their own. While based on information they believe is reliable, neither Arete Wealth nor its affiliates warrants its completeness or accuracy, nor do their opinions reflect the opinion of Arete Wealth. This podcast is for general informational purposes only and should not be regarded as specific advice or recommendations for any individual. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. The show hosts offer investment advice through Arete Wealth Advisors, LLC, an SEC-registered investment advisor, and securities through Arete Wealth Management, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC, and NFA. Finally, our music is The Chance by Jason Shaw and Audionautics. It's part of the YouTube audio library and it's licensed under a Creative Commons license. I am Ray Voices. Thank you for listening.